Assume if others come, we'll just add them to the proceedings. My first move is, and I want to go right through so we don't have to stick around longer than we wish. I want to greet everyone who's remote if you happen to look at our or listen to our audio file. So you have our greeting from here in Tucson, there in Harvard and Wales and Italy and Hawaii and what's the other one? Oh, Las Vegas. All right, so now I've done that. So my first move is to, once we get our film made, and this is, we know we're going to do it, when we get it made, I would like to move that we dedicate this film to Jack Harris, who was an early Shakespearean scholar who supported us when we really needed a Shakespearean scholar. So what do you do now? Do I just call for a vote? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Okay, anybody opposed? All right, then it's unanimously moved that we dedicate this film to Jack Harris, an early important supporter of our film. All right, now moving on to the more perhaps lengthy thing. I only have one copy of this. I can pass it around to you with my markings on it. Howard, did you print out the comments?
Oh, no, if you'd have told me, but I read it.
Oh, okay, you
read
it.
Recently,
well,
so
I'll, anybody who wants to look at it, I'll summarize if you want to see
yeah,
what
I would
the
like
comments
to.
Were. Okay.
Yeah.
The comments were varied. We had two that were more lukewarm to warm, and then one that was barely touching on most of the issues and answered only one thing. And the third one was mixed. I would say definitely mixed. And the areas that I think we can quickly address were, Howard, this has to do with you, that last one, he didn't bother with any of the parts that he was supposed to answer except about filmmaking. And he said, why isn't this just a play? And he said, I want to see more evidence that the filmmakers are involved in every stage of this
sure.
script development. So I think with a few sentences here and there, we can answer all that, you know.
Well, I think so, too. I think it's one really important thing here is, and I'm new to this process, but if we're applying for a development grant and they want to know that we already have everything developed,
mm-hmm.
this is unnerving to me. So
yes.
are we supposed to say, come pay us for all these things we've already done? See, this
mm-hmm.
is what makes
mm-hmm.
me nervous, if that's what they're
Well, there's another
implying,
thing that makes me
especially
nervous.
Especially about budget and about script, like they talked about.
Yeah.
It seems like there's too much, too many experts and not enough Shakespeare and Galileo and,
mm-hmm.
and all these other things are
yes.
based on just a few sentences that we put in
mm-hmm.
just in a general way to say, this is the project we're going to develop into a
And
script.
We have a page length, you know, on this
yeah.
form, and we have to hit all the A through Q, and so we don't have room to really expand a lot. But
well, if there's places for attachments or something, I know that we still have this NSF grant
mm-hmm.
outstanding, and are we going to run into the same thing where that we're asking them to pay us to develop something, but they want a lot more evidence that we've developed it?
No, I mean, NSF, well, NEH should also keep the distinction between development work, which is a smaller grant, and
mm-hmm.
the main deal. So, I don't think that's a criticism that has to be responded to if it wasn't the intent
right.
of the
oh, okay.
program.
And that was one person, and I should remind everyone that we get a full new set of peers the next time when we apply. And I also want to, this is in the agenda, that if we do apply again, I'd like to take up a collection to pay Howard for the 8 DVDs that they are going to require again. So
I can tell you right now that Coyote Moon Films is willing to donate 8 DVDs, no problem.
Oh, really?
Oh,
well,
sure.
We're willing
sure.
to
well,
take
that's
up
good.
A little
no, no,
selection
no.
here.
We've been selling some at
mm-hmm.
Borders and Barnes & Noble, and
oh, good.
We have some money for that, so
well,
okay.
we appreciate that donation to the cause. Anyway, that was the first one that I thought we could polish off fairly quickly. The other ones were, oh, can I borrow those notes back, whoever has them? Okay.
Yeah.
Because I need to look at them. I think one of the first person, this was the one that got laughs from some of the people on our team, where he says, good, but not extensively fleshed out at this stage. I would question the site of this project. Is the University of Arizona a leading center for the science side of this work?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there you go.
And I actually consulted with my mentor, and I said, do you see that this proves why we need better communications between science and the humanities? And he didn't think it was as funny as I did, but...
Actually, I could suggest that we are a leading center. Mm-hmm. And I think the one of the major examples of that is the Tuesday evening Stewart Observatory public lectures. A
right.
lot of those are interdisciplinary.
That's quite
and a lot
so.
Of them are designed to encourage the cross
So one
interest
sentence maybe
among,
mentioning that in the next time we
I would very
up.
Strongly suggest that,
yes.
Yes,
and also that we have a copy of Sidereus Nuncius and what's the next thing? Just about the place. I didn't say much about the place. My error, duh. I assumed everyone knew that astronomy was a big thing. All right, I'm going to interrupt here and introduce our new arrival. And could we all pass Gary this copy of the folder and the agenda? This
Thank
is
you,
Gary
Gloria.
Meckler from Pima. He is the lead faculty in STEM at the West Campus of Pima Community College.
Hi.
And,
hello.
I just chose unwisely where to park. I had a plan to just go to the Second Street garage and save all the driving around looking for a place to park. Wrong.
Yes.
Yeah. Said it was full up, so I drove around and easily found a place to park on Second. But, sheesh.
Okay, well, we're mucking our way.
I had the same issue.
Just so you know what's going on here, we're mucking our way through the evaluations on our first attempt to get a National Endowment Grant. And we've addressed the issue of why it's a film and not a theater, and I think we, you know, theatrical presentation, we can polish that off in a sentence or two and bring it into the outline that, you know, they're doing site surveys and things, you know, and that'll be right in our outline now. The second issue that I think a couple of them mentioned was the significance of the site or that we didn't mention it. And we are up against, this is what you should know, we are up against other projects in the NEH, like Emily Dickinson's Amherst, you know, and where they're really hyping that this is American and it's this one place. So right now we're hovering, we don't have a location. You see what I'm saying? So if we emphasize, has to be done here in Tucson, Arizona, great American city of astronomy. You know. So then we're meeting them on their own ground and they're not topping us on that one. That was the second one. And I guess the third one was just their feeling that it was a bit far out, as someone said on my fourth page. Interesting premise, but too far out. And after discussion, after someone said that and then convinced this person, then it was, you know, a little bit less after final rating. But they still felt it had merit, this anonymous person. I think that we have more evidence than we showed the first time around. We're doing two things. We're proving that Shakespeare and Galileo were both revolutionizing their worlds, their separate worlds, you know, in parallel ways, but not identical. But now we've started uncovering more evidence that Shakespeare knew this Diggs family, who were the, as it turns out, the more I dig, no pun intended, the more I find that they were the preeminent astronomy family in Elizabethan England, I thought. He knew them. He was even the stepfather that fathered the two boys after Mr. Diggs died. And I'm not going to get into all that. You've had emails on that. The stepfather was the executor of Shakespeare's will. So he knew the boys right after the father, Thomas Diggs, had put out Pantometria. It was news. And then he died. And just this is all within a few years. So they still would have been saying his great achievement because of the recently departed and everything. So we have more on that. And one of our consultants over in Italy, and if you want to address this from the Shakespearean scholars' qualms, that's okay too. But one of our people in Italy, that's Darko Subin, the cultural theorist, feels we'd be leading with a stronger approach if we didn't qualify all over the place. I was being so careful saying possibly could have known, maybe.
Actually, wasn't the father Leonard?
That was the grandfather. See,
there's the grandfather Leonard, then there was Thomas, and there was another Leonard.
Yeah,
family.
And Leonard the second, I don't know how to refer to him, the grandson Leonard, is the one that wrote the letter that they first decided which Will Shakespeare of Stratford. Evidently, it wasn't that uncommon a name. There were others. And it's because of this letter from Leonard Diggs, the poet, that they decided it's that Will Shakespeare. So these are people with a crucial connection already to Shakespeare. And they are this preeminent astronomy family. So, you know, where we want to go with that or how we phrase it, I think just there's a point to what Darko Savine says. He said, you just say, we're going to prove this, and then we'll get into the details later. We don't have to say he possibly knew, because that's waving a red flag of, oh, they don't have much evidence. And obviously, some of these people are not Shakespeareans. They don't know that much. I'm not saying we're pulling a fast one, but they don't know. But if you point out, oh, look, we know something, they go, oh, look how weak their evidence is. And then we could say, we will establish this, but then we'll have people that will not go along with it. And that's fine in a documentary. We want differences of opinion. But coming in with a strong claim rather than, oh, well, here's my, maybe we can.
Well, just to maybe put all the caveats just in one place, and then after that be very strong. I mean, you because there's
right.
There are people that will still ding you for being overly certain or whatever, but I think you could have the best of both of those by not.
I really highlighted all those may have and could haves, and much less of that, I guess, might be more. I want to introduce our historian, our general historian. This is Professor Frederick Kellogg.
Oh, me?
Yeah.
Oh.
Hi, Fred. And we're very happy to have Fred. He's a period expert, so you know anything that's general, I'm sure he can be a big assistance to our group on that.
I have a question that the NEH brought up there too,
mm-hmm.
and I worry about it with the NSF grant as well. If the film focuses on the scholarship of what we can find out about the two men in their own time,
mm-hmm.
and what they might have known about astronomy in the one place and what they might have known about they writing in
yes,
the other
right.
place. I mean,
well,
that's,
it's not
that's,
a might, though, on Galileo's. It's a definite. Yeah.
No, it's a definite.
Yeah.
But that focus is scholarship, but then our premise that we are trying to bring science and humanities to the table together
mm-hmm.
is more of a fictional construct in the film. That's
mm-hmm.
that's where we have Galileo and Shakespeare looking on us today from this fictional place, from
mm-hmm.
this celestial pub where
yes,
they
right.
where they are,
and the other sites that we yeah.
yes, but
is,
that's the crux of what we're trying to do is to build a bridge between the two major fields there.
Mm-hmm.
But unless I'm misreading what the NEH folks said, they had a problem with us even trying to do that there's plenty out there already about Galileo and Shakespeare separately, and
mm-hmm.
that there's interdisciplinary things everywhere, and that this isn't really a problem,
mm-hmm.
and that the fictional construct, that part of the premise of our movie,
mm-hmm.
is unnecessary or unneeded, and where I stand, I would feel like that it is
so
needed. I actually feel like the scientists that have been talking on your, you know, the science side that has been talking in the emails about
mm-hmm.
this seems to see a little bit better than these humanities folks that there might be some benefit here.
To the fictional part. And we need to justify
yeah.
it maybe to them if they're going to be making little complaints why we need a fictional part.
But not having done these kind of grants before, that's another big question I have. Is
mm-hmm.
anything, if there's
mm-hmm.
anything in this that's fictional, even a little bit, and it isn't pure scholarship, are we losing the battle here for the money? Are they going to turn us down because it's not pure scholarship? It's not revealing scholarship or educating the population about the scholarship that we've
done.
Well,
we should dig for something that was fictional. I know it's out there. They have done things that aren't just strictly fictional. I mean, that are strictly nonfiction. So we'll just find something to point at and say, like this one, you know, that was so successful.
Well, I wanted to ask Dr. Impey that
one,
though.
I can't speak to what NEH do or don't fund. NSF, in formal science, will definitely fund. I mean, they're reaching a broad audience, and they understand that, you know, science films and TV that they funded in the past, you know, often have fictionalized elements. I mean, they put most of Bill Nye Science Guy's funding in place, and he has little fantasy sequences and all sorts of things. So it's there are plenty of examples of where NSF will do that.
I'll try to look through the literature and find something parallel that's in the humanities, something that they have funded in the past. It's out there.
If they need us to say that about the script of the movie ahead of time, we can say that scholarship about this or that truth about Galileo or Shakespeare in the past leads us, then that's a transition into what our guys in the Celestial Pub are saying to each other and they're talking about today, so that there's always a connection. I mean, we can always make a connection, or if they speculate about something that happened to them in their own time, then we can have experts talking about the scholarship on that and still come back to them talking about today and where science and humanities are at today. So I think in screenplay terms, we can take them in and out of that. My only fear was that anything that wasn't pure scholarship was going to be a negative for us.
Well, I'll look into that, Howard, and see if I can find some examples that seem to be analogous that we can cite. That should help us. And I think those were the three major areas. That there were other little cavils, but those were the three biggies, I think. And if anybody wants to look at it, I sent you all an email, and I would have copied it, but it was, you know, so many things I was doing. And you have it, so just look it over if you want all the details. Oh, now where's
I lost you, I'm sorry. Are you talking about the NEA NEH review?
Yeah. Agenda, I don't know which agenda is here.
Yeah.
I'll give it back to you, I promise.
Sure, that's fine.
Okay, is there any more discussion on the evaluation? And people who are listening in to the audio, feel free, if you've looked at the comments on the NEH evaluation, just send us all an email if you have your comments, too. Anybody local wants to make a comment on the evaluations? Okay, Fred, you're going to have to speak very loud because I know your voice.
It's not that important.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it is.
Go ahead.
Okay.
The critics were not critical, but they bought their own story. But they didn't come across to me anyhow. In reading all four of them, that they knew much about what they were talking about. But it seemed like that there was an absence of know-how. I oversimplified, I don't see how Jeff could be so. Agreeable to such critiques, especially the last two, which are total disasters. Nothing was there in the last two at all. The first two at least made the effort, but I thought it was a washout, quite frankly, but as far as the NEH is concerned.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I don't think that they took it seriously, and I think especially reviewer of number four really didn't say anything, just said, nah, you know.
Yeah, especially giving us that low rating and not even bothering to throw
I think that really the idea of having to prove this and to prove that isn't really what we're all about. We're really trying to inspire people to see across cultural boundaries. Artists to see what's happening or happened in the sciences, and scientists to look and see how the early modern period in English literature was relating to that. And Shakespeare represents one, Galileo represents the other, and we use them really as signposts to build what we want to do.
Exactly.
Which is really to inspire people to see cross-culturally and across disciplines.
We first have to inspire the referees.
It doesn't help to complain to NEH staff about their peer review process, but I would say it would have to be done fairly carefully. But I think it's worth pointing out that we had reviewers that were non-responsive to the charge, and one that was clearly, I mean, using the word ignorant is a little dangerous, but I mean, you
yes,
can
yes.
point, the program officers are culpable if they don't choose good reviewers, and then you die by that sword. So, and in a oversubscription of 10-1, that means you have no chance, because it's a lottery at some level anyway.
Well, you saw my,
yeah,
my
like
cap, too, that half
lottery.
Of them or more may have been previous winners, and that gives them
right.
the ability to be toppers, you know, and say, in my last grant, you know.
Right, but so that's trickier because you don't know, you're not going to get enough of the backdrop information to judge that. But just within the review, it's not responsive to
mm-hmm.
the charge to the reviewer. Just say, this review should have been discounted because it was not responsive to what they were asked to do. So, and that hurts a proposal when you have any reviewers that aren't responsive.
How would you rate them if they had been NSF reviewers?
Oh, you would never get threadbare. Would never get
you wouldn't get
that threadbare.
Okay.
No, there, you have to answer every question has to be answered. It's fleshed out. It's
mm-hmm.
pulled together in a panel so that if individuals are a little delinquent, you know,
uh-huh.
they're sort of held
uh-huh.
to task by the chair of the panel, who's a peer reviewer, not an NSF person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's sort of been a bruising. Iterative development of peer review at NSF over decades.
So
because people complain, because scientists are not shy about complaining when they get not just bad reviews, but badly formed reviews.
Well,
so,
then humanities people are going to have to be the fit, I think.
But, you know, it's not a prescription for success, of course.
No.
It's just.
What was the number of, was it over 100 grant applications?
126, I think.
126,
yeah,
nine passed. You know, if I were in that numbing situation, I could surely find nine that stood out as being the ones we won and not pay much mm-hmm. attention to everything else. I don't know how insightful that is.
But you
but
don't get to do it that way around. I mean, everyone gets overlapping batches of proposals, and you don't know until you go to the meeting how it's going to shake down.
It's not the same review panel for the entire 120.
No, see, we're not privy to that information,
right.
how they did it.
Well, I mean, the thing that's important then, given that just complaining about the reviews doesn't
mm-hmm.
help, is it's also dangerous to jump through little strange shaped hoops that were erected by individual reviewers. That,
right.
You know,
because
you roll the dice and
right.
you get a whole new
right.
set of people. So only if there's any commonality in the reviews
mm-hmm.
is it worth paying attention to at all, I would say.
Okay,
unless uh-huh. there's just a factual thing pointing
right.
out.
Right.
I think it might be good to make it easier for the review board in the sense that, as you point out, they're looking at lots and lots of proposals.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an apples and oranges proposal.
Right.
And if we're not exactly sure what it is, then that ambivalence will show up in their review.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you went to the National Endowment for the Humanities and you had something like, we're going to examine performances of Shakespeare in the Old West.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Shakespeare's patriotic, but you've got the American Old West.
Mm-hmm.
They think they know what you're talking about, whether they do or not.
Mm-hmm.
We might want to, in any scientific area, if we're dealing with the NEH, explain the science to them. Not too patronizingly, but on a real basic level,
mm-hmm.
that Tucson is a center for astronomy. Kitt Peak, the LBT, a heritage going back to the days of Tombstone, and Lowell, and all that
mm-hmm.
stuff. And then the inspiration of Shakespeare here and the inspiration of Galileo. And then we go into a very problematic area, this notion of dramatic enactment. Carl Sagan in Cosmos had dramatic reenactments of things that historians of astronomy think happened. In the NOVA program on Galileo's daughter, there are dramatic reenactments of things that people, you know, think really happened. We're not really doing that, right? We're doing a dramatic enactment of something that might happen or might have happened, but definitely didn't happen. But wouldn't it be cool
mm-hmm.
if we
yeah,
could
yeah,
get Shakespeare
exactly.
and Galileo
right.
to do lunch?
That's right.
And so we might want to lead with the very impossibility of this, and yet how great this would be. On the matter of Diggs and the telescope and the connection with Shakespeare and actually tying together Galileo and Shakespeare, it's my impression that documentary television shows celebrate an insight after it's already been demonstrated in a book. Again, Galileo's daughter is an example of that. Mm-hmm. It wasn't really new, but she brought it to light.
Right.
And then you had the NOVA program. That tends to be the usual pattern. But here we seem to be suggesting that there are connections and that we're going to show them in the program. And that might give people on an NEH board a little bit of hesitation. And so it's a mean trick here. We've got apples, oranges, and bananas. But what I think we should do is one, make them comfortable with the genre. Okay, this is what this is going to be. And not have them questioning themselves about that. And then hit them with something that's distinctive. That you've never seen this before. But if you let us make this, you're going to see it. Mm-hmm. And I think the real center is probably a brilliant conversation between Shakespeare and Galileo.
I'm just reminded of, what's his name, the comedian, Steve Allen's dinner with all these people from history. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that might be a nice perspective. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, Meeting of the Minds.
Meeting of the Minds.
A number of people have mentioned that. We're doing something similar to that, in a way.
Something.
An older ancestor is Heinrich von Linn, back after World War II, a mm-hmm. Dutch writer. I don't know if you've ever, anybody ever heard of von Linn's Lives?
Mm-hmm.
They would write down on a sheet of paper the people they wanted to come to dinner, and they would put it underneath the lion in the city hall,
mm-hmm.
And then they would show up at dinner, and they would bring, you know, the Empress Theodosia and Napoleon.
That's great.
It was fun.
I'd like to second what Richard said. I like very much what David said about going across boundaries, but we don't want to have this project rest on the foundation of the Diggs family and mm-hmm. Shakespeare's connection to them, because despite the all the reference Shakespeare makes in his plays to astronomical events, we cannot prove in the plays themselves that Shakespeare knew Galileo's work.
Mm-hmm.
It's very tenuous.
Right. That's true.
It is tenuous, but it is, and I agree with you on that, but I think it's also also attractive in some way. For example, in Cymbeline, there is a reference to, an indirect reference to Jupiter's moons coming down as four ghosts descending from the sky
mm-hmm.
and around the goddess Jupiter. There is evidence to connect that with Sidereus Nuncius.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if we want to go that way, my point, though, is that maybe the whole idea is that we shouldn't be trying to prove A, B, and C so much as we're trying to inspire mm-hmm. X, Y, and Z.
Well, you could even do something as tricky as this, and this might pacify them. You could have Galileo, since they're outside of time, asking Shakespeare, you know, well, was that a reference to me? I like it when people have read my book, you know. And then Shakespeare could be saying, well, do you think it's so? You know, or something vague where he's not really answering.
I think you've hit on a very good thing that we'd want to put in our drama mm-hmm. There. Shakespeare probably saying, well, if you think so, then it was.
Yeah, like any good playwright, you know, if that's what moved you. but, you know, then we could have our scholar then correct, you know, Shakespeare being so coy and say, but actually, you know, what we know. But
well,
I think that's
it's an uneasy thing. It's the apples and oranges that he was just talking about, that we shouldn't. We shouldn't have to apologize or justify that we're jumping off from the scholarship
mm-hmm.
into fictional,
so how do you
into
feel
fictional
about
territory.
That?
Well, I think, as David pointed out, it can be very useful
mm-hmm.
and exciting. But I mean, I can see a hard-headed panelist reviewing this saying, where's the beef?
I didn't even get the impression that they knew that much Shakespeare. I think they were just signaled by our verbs.
I really do. I think these were people who may not have been Shakespearean scholars at all, and it was simply the verbs that gave it away. Because when you say could have known, might have, then they go, oh, this is speculative stuff. And that was my impression. You know, I read it over and over. Because I, you know, you're getting people who may, they're not all in the areas, the precise areas. They're people who are eminent in some humanities field. I don't know that they actually went out of their way to get the Shakespeare. They may have been. But none of them spoke from a very knowledgeable Shakespearean perspective.
Have you talked to Stephen Greenblatt about this?
Yes, I did. And he said, he was saying he thought it might be nice to do, this is just in a one-sentence answer with a couple other comments, he thought it might be nice to do a period, invoke the period of someone that they that Shakespeare might have met. And I, but see, he was going into the might have, that could have actually influenced him in reality. And I said, but you see, you're on that same ground of might have met. Yeah, Judge, what's his name, D, and all these people, he, Bacon, he might have met. And I, they would hit, that that might have is what would key them, because they may not be Shakespeareans, but they'll say, oh, this is speculation here.
Except, yeah, that's a very good point. And if Stephen asked a question like that, mm-hmm. My guess is that he's lifting from his own biography of Shakespeare, Will and the World, where he takes a lot of liberties with Shakespeare and what he might have done and whom he might have known. But just like, you know, in 400 years from now, there, someone might ask, did you and I know each other? And without any solid evidence, we haven't signed any contracts or anything. But I think it would have been very unusual that we wouldn't have met somewhere
well,
along
the line. We know Shakespeare knew the Diggs family. It's
Shakespeare lived a few blocks from the Diggs family. They all kind of lived in the same area, and they all saw each other's works, and they all got drunk together and had a good time.
It does take more research to see what the impact of pantometria was, and if we could really say it was so widely spoken of, you know we knew about it.
Let me just say a word about Stephen Greenblatt. He's the most important and the most influential Shakespearean in the world. His book, Will and the World, is the most exciting book on Shakespeare I've ever read. Stephen Greenblatt invented what's called the new historicism, which is the reigning approach to Shakespeare in academia. But I must tell you at the same time that when Stephen's book came out, it was panned by a lot of academics. Why? Because they said it's speculation. And they're very uncomfortable with depending upon speculation. Now, Greenblatt, to his credit, in his introduction says, this is a speculation. But the critics reviewing his book, in many cases, damned it for that very speculation.
Yes,
and you see,
yes.
It's the same mindset of the reviewers on that panel.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how we get around that.
See, this is my fear. This is why I brought up the whole issue about speculation anyway, is that we are up against people who are immediately not disposed to funding us because speculation is part of what we're doing. You know?
So we have to somehow finesse across this divide of, you know, hardcore, peer-reviewed, rigorous academia, which has its own boundaries and rules and guidelines. And this is a project to reach a large audience, to, you know, inspire people. It's not pitched just at experts. I mean, if you have experts, you know, generating your project and containing your knowledge base from which it emerges, you shouldn't be dinged for being creative and speculative and integrative in what you produce, because you still have that solid base of scholarship and knowledge. So we somehow have to finesse that so that, I agree, it was dinged for that, I agree.
Yeah.
Well, this is exactly what he's talking about with Will and the World. There is a solid base of scholarship there. He researched extensively about what was going on in England at the time. And knowing the world that this man lived in allows you to make speculation that's not uninspired, not unrealistic. It's not unrealistic speculation by any means. And in fact, real revelation.
So what you have to do is you have to flush out the reviewers or keep them honest enough to maintain the distinction between, you know, speculation for its own sake and speculation grounded in and emerging from scholarship that you can't question, because
Or maybe comparing it with Greenblatt's book specifically,
right.
And saying how clearly he based things on rock hard evidence and then made very judicious, I say, speculation.
Still going
to
give us problems. You're absolutely right on that.
Yeah.
But I totally agree with what you're saying about Stephen, and also my own experience with him, the fact that he was so quick to respond to my emails, maybe we wanted to get him a little more active in what we're doing.
Right.
I think if we're going to suck at this, we should suck with style. we want to do this, we want to be speculative,
yeah.
We should come out with a flag about it.
Mm-hmm.
This is why we have to be speculative, and we're beginning with a premise that could not possibly have happened. Galileo and Shakespeare did not ever meet. We're imagining that they did. Therefore, we feel that we can imagine that other things might have, you know, we were constructing a conversation built on our understanding of Shakespeare's view of the world and Galileo's view of the world, which in many ways were very different.
Mm-hmm.
And giving them a lot of chance to yell and scream at each other, but emerge good friends at the end.
Yeah.
I think we should do it. We should hit this speculation bit with style and
that's right.
Be proud of
and
it.
And not cringe and be like the little church mouse that I was in the first one.
Had they met, what could we speculate that Shakespeare would write based on what he's learned from meeting Galileo? I mean, how much does astronomy today inspire art and music and literature? If I can include science fiction in that.
Oh, sure.
All the time. Just my daughter's an artist in San Francisco, and the Hubble telescope pictures of the galaxies, enormous inspiration to lots of different people there.
Sure.
The crossover is there, but the danger, one of the things that can come out of this conversation is that humanity needs to evolve. And their evolution of an understanding between the two of them is an inspiration, like you're saying, an inspiration for humanity to evolve the same way. You know, to say that science and the humanities aren't in two different worlds; they're on the same small planet. You know, and have that kind of.
They're both intellectual approaches to life.
Which inspires me, but it is speculation. I mean, there's no getting around that.
We'll be proud of that. That's part of what we're doing.
Can we go back to the question, where's the beef?
Mm-hmm.
From the point of view of the NEH reviewers, where might the beef be located in all of the things that we have going on here?
I don't know, Richard.
Well, that's the cognitive hook that Richard Greenblatt said we may need a little bit stronger cognitive hook. So we'll have to work on that. And I'm going to be passing this version 2 to all of you to get your assistance and help to help beef it up, no pun intended. Any other comments and suggestions before we, you know, move on?
What's the situation with the NEA? If we were to emphasize the creative element, filmmaking, writing dialogue, performing reenactment, and yet integrating insights from Shakespeare on the one hand and from Galileo on the other. Is the situation at the National Endowment for the Arts such that they would look at something like this?
I briefly looked at the NEA, and I can't remember. I guess I didn't see anything that was a development stage grant, or I'll have to go back and look at their websites again. I did
their
briefly.
Funding is under attack.
Oh, yeah.
Every 6 months. And they have just a lot less to deal with, but to use even, than NEH.
I think maybe that was something that I saw.
If we sign a no nudity agreement,
maybe. On the other hand,
there's
a book.
Shakespeare
and Galileo
in
a hot tub in the nude, fucking.
Something else that you might want to consider is that the Templeton Foundation's theme for this fall is awe and wonder.
Oh. Whoa.
And they're looking for proposals on the theme of awe and wonder.
Okay.
And
that
I would actually love to lose my application with them to this application with them. As long as something with them gets going.
Very good. Yeah, that deadline's October 15th.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're a bit over the hill with that one. But we can catch their next cycle.
Which would be March.
Okay.
With probably a slightly different theme.
And the next deadline for the National Endowment for the Humanities is January 12th, 2011.
Well, actually, I wouldn't dismiss the, it's good that David brought it up, I wouldn't dismiss the Templeton option so quickly. It's because it's a two-stage process, and the deadline that's coming up is just to be, you know, in the pool and invited to propose, and it's a web form. I mean,
web form? Yeah, we could go for that.
Well, significant numbers of words. As I recall, there's like five or six sections. 1,000 to 3,000 words. I mean, it's not trivial, but it's all on the web, and so you can prepare your pieces. And
you can even save what you've done and come back to it the next day.
And then there's some critical final element, which is responsiveness to Sir John's donor bequest or whatever. So you have to click to a link of what Sir John Templeton was all about.
Oh, okay.
He funded his foundation, and you have to, in addition to the awe and wonder to the themes that they have, you have to connect to his donor wishes.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure. But David, did you get that far in the form? Do you know?
I'm about at that point.
Okay.
It's kind of interesting what he wants to fund, but it really, when you look at what he wants to fund, and you know, the private sector might be a richer area for us.
Well,
in
we're
one
moving,
or
we're
way.
Segueing to the next item, and that's it has to do with that.
Okay.
So if that's all right, I'd like to move
so
us into the next item, which, since I'm one short, I have to look over Fred's shoulder.
Oh, no,
yes.
Please.
Oh, no, that's okay.
Agenda, you mean?
No. On our agenda here, I don't think Fred got a copy of the agenda, so if someone could show.
I have an extra one.
Do you have an extra? Oh, that's where it went. I knew I had enough. Almost enough. I didn't make one for me because I thought I had that in the notebook. But anyway, the next agenda item, if we've wrapped up pretty much our comments on the National Endowment evaluation discussion, is that I discussed with Gail Godby. By the way, her father was in my Ives play, Howard.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so I got that little extra credit there. And Kelly Holt. Gail is from the College of Humanity. Kelly is from the Gift Center. And there's also another person that I talked to who's the science counterpart development of the College of Science. And I haven't gotten much farther than just talking to that person, introducing ourselves. I think that's Bob Logan, the one I mentioned here. And I did get the information on how we set up an account. It comes through our business department, which would be Lourdes if we run it through English. Probably, would you agree, Chris, that English is better than trying to run funding, accounting things through astronomy?
Yeah.
I don't think they're nearly as busy.
Lourdes is very good.
And she's good. So, so we'll set up our account with the foundation. And then, inspiringly, Gail said we should always believe in our project, and you'd be amazed who comes out. And she said I should ask you at this meeting to begin thinking of a couple people that you would invite personally to come to some event, maybe a public evening. And I thought a public evening rather than these house salons. They started telling me about in people's houses, and I got this, oh no, Tupperware, you know. But I thought more like a public evening. And then it came to me like a flash. I don't know, I get these occasional brainstorms. I thought, well, we have Steve Pompey, who from the Kuiper meetings that I've been to, I know dresses up like Galileo. Do you know that? We have an astronomer, Howard, who dresses up like Galileo. And
you have a Kenny Act. No.
All right, all right. Everyone seems to enjoy his Galileo. And I got really fast on the phone, and I actually touched base with this fellow, Steve Pompey, and he said, oh, I'm so interested. Keep me in the loop. And if I can do it, if it's okay and we can hit a time when I can do it, I will do it.
His last letter in his A, so it's Pompey.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Like in his email.
I just, you know, I got, that's a, you know, subliminal thing. So anyway, Steve Pompey says that he's interested as long as we can hit the times that he's available. Then my inspiration further went on that Roger Angel, are you familiar with Roger Angel, Fred?
I don't know that yet.
He's, okay, he's world famous. He's world class. He works in the, I believe, does he, Chris, work in optical sciences?
No, he's here.
Oh, he's here, okay. And he just got a Kavli Award, that's the Norwegian equivalent to the Nobel Prize, for his work in optics. And what I was thinking is that wouldn't it be neat to do an old and new theme? You know, we have the man who was the founder of optics, pretty much, you know, Galileo, who founded the field, and then we have the latest person that's doing these really fantastic, cutting-edge, modern things. And they both, like bookends, so to speak, are at our evening.
You could actually almost say that Roger is the Stephen Greenblatt of optics.
All right, Roger's the Stephen Greenblatt of optics. So we could have this evening, and they would warm up the crowd by, you know, Galileo being in character and Roger Angel just being himself, and we'll you know, we can hash out what they would do, what they would say. But I think with those two, that would be enough to get people to come out, and it would be entertaining. It could end with a little pitch and a little fundraising, too. Do you all think that might be worth pursuing? Yeah.
Not so sure about the fundraising aspect of it. I know I'm giving a talk to the Yale people.
Right, for our
group. Loosely based on this group coming up around Christmas time. But but other than that, I think this is a wonderful way to go.
Well, we could be really low-key, like just envelopes as they come in. They can choose to pick up or not, you know. Here's how, little envelope.
Yeah.
But no, it could just be simply, if you'd rather the group, the sense of the meeting here is we'd rather just do it to get visibility. We could do it as that, or we could do fundraising. Of course, the gift center, they all want you to do, you know, salons / fundraisers, so... That's up to us, though. We don't have to do the fundraising part. But, you know, eventually we do have to get money from different sources. So possibly just by making ourselves known, then some of the people that have money and are interested in this kind of thing will give money without being asked. It could happen. So that was their advice. You know, I was really looking for the wonderful, rich pool of donors up in the foothills where she'd just give me a name and then I'd have to go meet somebody and say, don't you want to give us a lot of money? But it doesn't. She said it doesn't work like that anymore, if it ever did. And it's more that you build this space by becoming very visible and then people, the word, you know, branches out to all these people that are out there somewhere. So that's another avenue. And people do sometimes raise quite a bit of local money by being visible, and people who are, you know, philanthropists in the arts and sciences, when they hear the need is there, they actually come to the fore. Look at all the donations the Poetry Center has gotten. You know, just people that are maybe have written one poem once and they give $10,000 because they like poetry.
Thanks for mentioning that, because Shakespeare is involved in writing poetry,
mm-hmm.
and his poems are fascinating. And I haven't heard anything about poetry being part of the story here. But in making a movie,
mm-hmm.
It seems poetry would play a big role. I know that in my own experience, writing poetry can be extraordinarily exciting. And it can be, part of the story that we're trying to tell. And connected to poetry is music. And I keep thinking over and over again, Gloria,
mm-hmm.
that why not include folk songs? That is in the case of my own area, the Chardash and the Hora and so forth. I'm not thinking now of the tango or the rumba or for that matter, the foxtrot. But the dances of the time, the music of the time, it seemed to me could be part of the ball game here in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And the music, can be quite exciting, actually.
That's right. It adds a whole dimension that would be missing. And I know Howard is in charge of that, but I see he's busily making a note there. So,
I have a composer that works with Coyote Moon Films, and if we told him, look, we want to score this Celestial Pub with folk music from the time, that would sound good to him. He would
and he could
go off and research that. But we're trying to raise money to do exactly that. I'm afraid if I say we've got this person already researching. Do I need to tell them we've already got someone researching folk music from London and Rome at the time in order to use it? Do I have to say that in order for them to give us money? I was hoping they would give us money because they know that we have people that we would be doing
good,
that
yeah.
research.
Well,
I don't know. So.
It's a tough call, but I appreciate all your comments. And just to keep things rolling, because we don't have unlimited, you know, time this evening, I would like to then go to our next agenda item, which is...
As
we
long
just,
as my point is clear, though.
Poetry, yeah.
dance, and music.
Right.
Fantastic.
No, we agree.
The Trinity, which would be unbeatable.
We
Let me
agree.
Make one more comment yeah. about the fundraising. I think, did you talk to Bob Logan or just...
No, I've left a message.
All right. I mean, it's worth pursuing a little because
mm-hmm.
The College of, well, first of all, Joaquin's the, you know, the super dean
mm-hmm.
now, so he should
right.
care about these interdisciplinary things.
Yeah,
the College of Science has a fundraising apparatus, the Galileo Circle, you know, so the
mm-hmm.
Galileo thing is built in on the ground
all
floor.
Right.
And of course, they have their own priorities of scholarships and fellowships and so on. But with fundraising, it's not always a zero-sum game. So there's always a danger when you put something new in the mix, you know, it's going to compete against the things that are science-focused that they want to tap that set of people for. But there may be some of the people in the Galileo Circle supporters who would respond to this and, you know, not
mm-hmm.
to the fellowships or scholarships on offer. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it's worth pursuing with Logan a little just to float that. It floated in that way, and if Joaquin, you know, was aware of it and took an active interest, I mean, he's a very highly multiplexed person, so you don't get much of his attention or time, but if he just beneficently thought, yeah, this is a good idea to have in the mix for the Galileo Circle, then it would just be on the plate whenever they, and they definitely go into the living rooms of those $3 million houses in the foothills
okay.
and so on,
well,
so there
are
some deep pockets in that group.
Right. Okay, well, that's good to know, and I will just at least make sure I have a one chat with him or a short meeting in person. The next item on our agenda is the. Did you get a chance to look at the Discovery Channel website?
Sure,
the
sure.
Portal for producers. How
sure.
Okay.
All right, I'll follow up on that, but they
okay.
are they're not a funding entity unless you pitch to them exactly
yeah.
what we're doing to the NEH and
mm-hmm.
and NSF and I will look into that
mm-hmm.
as well as pitching it to them, but then it's no different really from pitching it to the Galileo Circle or
mm-hmm.
or anyone else here.
Well, okay, so but there is a chance that
they
would
a,
up front help to develop something. It's not
sure.
just you bring them your finished film and then it goes on TV. They would help in
No, but they would fund something that then has to air first on the Discovery
right.
Channel.
Well,
and,
we understand
yeah, okay.
that, sure.
Right.
No, we understand that. They give the money, they get it first. So, or they get it with its label on it. All right, so that then further we'll table that and we'll get further details down the line. And our final thing that I think, well, if not final, at least the next thing that didn't make it on the agenda is that Ewan Whitaker kindly brought his working model of the perspective lens, and I think we should at least look at it since he brought it from home and it works, and it's probably what could have been the Elizabethan perspective lens.
Can I say just one thing about Where's the Beef before we're
oh,
done?
Oh, go ahead. Yeah. While he's unpacking, we
sure.
can talk about Where's the Beef.
I'm going to paraphrase something that Stephen Greenblatt said in Will and the World,
mm-hmm.
and that both of these men imagined a world that does not exist and then worked very passionately to find the truth of that imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes the scientist and the playwright closer than they realized, and I think that's the beef for me, anyway. In the
could you
in
send
the
me that phrase, that
sure.
sentence, and I will definitely see where I can.
It's similar to the one that I emailed him.
Mm-hmm.
We took a quote out of his book, and it's
mm-hmm. right,
similar.
Right.
To
yeah, that's a good one, and I'm sure that could be front loaded somewhere. So
It's amazing how much literature there is now out there on this.
Do you know there's actually evidence that Shakespeare had a perspective lens?
No.
Or that he used one? He writes about perspective lenses by name in two plays, Richard II and one of the Henrys. He actually mentions them as perspectives.
Fred, did you ever encounter the lines mentioning perspective lenses?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Okay. Sure.
But it could mean something else,
but
right?
What do we do with that information? That's the question.
Mm-hmm. Right,
how do you make that part of your application? I really think that maybe the secret of getting this thing funded is to enlist the talents of Stephen Greenblatt, because he invented what's called new historicism. And
right,
for those
right.
of you who are not in literature, what it basically does is say you don't look at a work of literature, whether a poem, a play, or a novel, in the abstract. You don't look at it apart from its culture. And so you look at it typically against the social or political or religious or scientific background at the time. And when Stephen Greenblatt formulated these ideas many years ago, he just electrified the profession. And almost overnight it changed. And it seems to me, if we could make use of his talents along those lines, we could...
How we could work in the Diggs thing. He
yes.
would have the talent to know how to put it over, so to speak.
I mean, no one does it better than he does.
Okay. Well, that's good. That's good. Well, I do want to give you a chance to expose us to the perspective lens, which took some doing.
Okay. I should introduce myself. I'm Ewan Whitaker. I've been retired from the Lunar and Planetary Lab for 23 years when I reached the magic age of 65. And so you can work out how ancient I am now. Of course, I'm a lunatic completely. I was with Gerard Kuiper from, well, I first met him in 1955 at an IAU meeting in Dublin in Ireland. And this was the time of the Kuiper and Urey disagreement, and I was there right at the time. And so Kuiper put out a memorandum. I'm interested in the moon. I want to make an atlas of moon pictures.
Thank you.
And with this atlas, we can study the moon, we can look at the moon and try and find out what's going on, because Urey was a cosmochemist. And he looked at the moon from the cosmochemist side with the nuclear physics and nuclear chemistry and all this sort of thing, whereas Kuiper was an out-and-out astronomer, got in from the telescope side and the astronomy side and looked at things from that direction. So anyway, he put out a memorandum at this meeting. I'm interested in the moon. Anybody interested in helping me make a moon atlas, please write to me after the meeting's over. And out of all the 800 or 900 people at the IAU meeting, I was the only one who answered him. That was amazing. Nobody was interested in the moon just after the war. Everything was galaxies and the star astronomy, because there was more money in it. Anyway, that's the way things started up. So I got into there as a... Well, I left for the Greenwich Observatory in those days and came over here. So I'm an import from London. And I really didn't get interested very much in the history of telescopes until people started writing about Galileo's pictures of the moon in Sidereus Nuncius. And there were well-known astronomers like Zdenek, Coppel, who had some quite nasty remarks about Galileo, saying he probably drunk too much, or you cannot correlate any of Galileo's pictures with what you see. It's all imagination. I thought, well, this doesn't sound very fair. So I did quite an analysis of Galileo's 7 pictures, and it all fitted in very nicely, and that I found the dates and the actual times in Padua when he must have looked at these phases of the moon to draw the pictures that he drew. And Owen Gingerich, who was a
historian of astronomy came along afterwards and said, well, this appears to be the definitive study of when Galileo drew his pictures, because before there was no consensus whatever. So that sort of interested me at the time, and then this was 1978. And then much later, there was an article in the BAA Journal, which is, the BAA is an amateur association and started in London in 1890, and it's worldwide, of course, and well respected. And there was an article in there about, somewhere amongst this, anyway, it was an article about the Diggs family and using mirrors and lenses of the time to see objects in the distance. And I don't know whether you've read any of these outlandish things that were written, but Thomas Diggs, in writing about his father, Leonard Diggs, who died in about 1560-something, my father, by his continual painful practices, assisted with demonstrations mathematical, was able, at sundry times, hath by proportional glasses, duly situate in convenient angles, not only discovered things far off, red letters, numbered pieces of money with the very coin and the superscription thereof, cast by some of his friends on purpose upon downs in open fields, but also 7 miles off declared what hath been done at that instant in private places. Well, now. And then a little further on, but marvelous what other conclusion may be performed by glasses concave and convex of circular and parabolical forms, using for multiplication of beams sometimes the aid of glasses transparent, which by fraction, refraction means, should unite or dissipate the image of figures presented by the reflection of others. By these kinds of glasses, or rather frames of them, placed in due angles. So twice this is saying that Leonard Diggs was experimenting with mirrors and lenses, but not in tubes, but out in the field somewhere. And there are pictures showing some of these things, looking at Navy ships, trying to find the distance of ships and so on. And so apparently the father, Leonard Diggs, or the grandfather, never made a telescope. But then we go on, and William Bourne was writing about this same thing, and he writes like this: yet I am assured that the glass that is ground, being of very clear stuff, that is glass, and a good largeness, and placed so that the beam doth come through, and so received into a very large concave looking glass, that it will show the thing of marvelous largeness in a manner uncredible, a new word, to be believed of the common people. Well, in more modern English, that says, I understand that the ray that passes through the large clear lens is received into a very large concave mirror. So that had got me thinking, because this writer of the article was trying to get the history of the reflecting telescope, and he didn't think this phrase meant anything, but I thought, well, I don't know. A telescope, after all, of the refracting type, consists of a lens at the normal end, as we know, and the other end, in the Galilean type, it has a negative lens, concave lens, and by putting these at the correct position for the particular focal lengths, you can get magnification. And that is what Galileo apparently worked out from seeing the Dutch telescopes of 1608. So I thought, well, a concave lens, that's a funny way of magnifying the image that the convex lens at the end is. is making. And of course, Kepler came along later and put a double convex lens at the end of his telescope and then used this to focus on the image which was being produced by that, and got the Keplerian telescope, which is the basis really of all the modern refracting telescopes. Well, I thought, well, if a eyepiece or a lens of short focus here can focus on the image, why can't we focus using a concave mirror? So I went to Edmunds Scientific Company, can't beat them for optical pieces, and got a 2-inch single lens, just a plain, it's not a plain convex, it happens to be a double convex lens, but that's all they had. And a 2-inch focal length, 100 millimeter concave mirror here. And made up this little simple telescope with a tube, and the focusing is at this end, and this magnifies exactly 9 times. Now this is roughly the same magnification that the Galilean telescope gives you, with one that is shorter, more compact, and you look through it this way. Now with this combination, which is based on the Diggs idea, you look into it this way, so what you want to look at is over there, and when you find it, you have an upside down image, but it's also a mirror image because you've got one mirror. So this really is not a practical way of making a telescope. Now, coming back to Diggs and Company, they didn't have nice lenses and mirrors like I could get. And he's talking about a very large concave mirror as the eyepiece. So I experimented with a large concave mirror and an eyepiece and a much longer focal length lens, and you get a very wide angle of field. I thought, oh, this is marvelous. But the problem is, in order to get any magnification, say you want a 20 power magnification, and down here you've got this very large concave mirror that he's talking about, I'll bet that was a mirror used, well, for nowadays, like we use shaving mirrors, quite a modest focal length. And so the focal length of this thing, to get any magnification, would have to be yards, and you cannot make a viable telescope that way. Yes?
I have a question.
Yes.
I think this is where we diverge from the real. I read in I'll have to find it again, but this was not the only case of extravagant claims, but there were a number of miraculous inventions in Elizabethan England that were being touted around. Mm-hmm. They could do this. They were called novelties. I don't know. And that Shakespeare heard all kinds of stories of things. This may not have been the only miraculous.
Yes.
You know, in one of the accounts of the Diggs thing, they were saying, well, this is one of these where it was in the air. They were always claiming they had spy glasses that could do this. Mm-hmm. And could. Does that ring a bell, Fred?
Well, I mean, telescopes were in wide use.
Right.
Especially by mariners.
But I mean exaggerated claims, you know, that, oh, you can see 5 miles and read a letter.
I can't think of any offhand, Gloria.
But it might have certainly inspired people like Shakespeare. And
yeah.
I found from Richard II, he says, for sorrow's eye, glazed with blinding tears, divides one thing entire to many objects, like perspectives, which rightly gazed upon show nothing but confusion.
Hmm.
Eye to eye, distinguished form.
That's pretty right technical.
Right on from Richard II.
Okay.
Yeah.
But the
very
that
good.
I was getting at was the exaggeratedness and the, you know, astrology was just dividing from astronomy, alchemy was just dividing from chemistry, and there were these, people had a belief in miraculous instruments, miraculous potions, you know, and that some of this optics was also in that stream of the miraculous, and that could have been inspiring to Shakespeare.
Yeah.
I would throw into this mix that there's been a lot of critical attention to who was doing what right around 1609, because Galileo gets a hold of the news in a letter, and is smart enough to build a telescope and then very quickly begins to build bigger and better ones. Before that, there are names in Holland of people. Hans Lipperhey tries to get a patent. There are a couple of other names. There's a report from the English ambassador in Paris in 1608 that people are using these tubes and they can see things far away and all that. And so, partly because Galileo is such a giant, that there are these skirmishes that go on about what happened earlier and later. And one figure that I've done some work on is Thomas Harriot. And in his case, it's easy because he made what he called a perspective trunk, aimed it at the moon, started making notes for a map of the moon, and the notes survive.
Yep.
They're before Galileo, and the map survives. And it's a very close correspondence to what you see when you look at the moon.
Yeah.
However, the plot thickens. In 1588, is that right? 1585, he goes to the New World, that is Harriot, Sir Walter Raleigh's expedition. He does all kinds of research there. But in the Brief and True Report of Virginia and all that, they describe using lenses to see things that are far away. And it's there's a lot of talk about lenses and angles and mirrors and refraction, but it's obviously not a telescope. And you kind of wonder what's going on. And then we begin to look at other kinds of manuscript evidence. Francis Bacon in 1250 is talking about how you can see things far away if you put these things together somehow. But you don't have a tube. He doesn't draw it out for you. You just get words saying that other people have done this. Now, in literary history, this begins to smell like a convention. That is, when you write something and you see it written over here and over here and over here, and it may or may not reflect reality.
That's what I was getting at.
What Bacon says is that Julius Caesar had these things before he invaded England.
Right.
And he set them up and used it to see what kind of defenses the Celts were making before he invaded. Nobody believes that, but it's there.
Right.
And so I kind of, on the other hand, we do know that Harriet did have the trunk a little bit later. And then by 1610, everybody's got them. They're all over the place.
Yeah.
And so it's a delicious area because people get really heated about it.
And then Shakespeare was hearing some of this, and some of, you know, you're showing up in his little mentions of perspective and perspective ones.
I think so. I mean, it's a safe bet that by 1610, everybody.
Except Shakespeare wrote this in like 1595, quite a bit earlier.
But as I was saying, there are all these swirling stories of miraculous objects because, you know, science is just moving away from astrology, is separating from astronomy.
Yeah.
There were, and I'll find it. If you want me to really dig it out, I'll find it. It's in one of those Shakespeare surveys or one of the articles that I gave all of you on the knowledge, I think it's the one knowledge, scientific knowledge, I sent it out of the time, Elizabethan, and they were going into all these stories of miraculous devices, you know, of various kinds.
It's enough for me that it was in the world.
Yes.
It's enough for me that it was in the world he was living in.
Right.
It's enough for me.
It was part of his,
I don't think
world
we're ever going to find a letter where Shakespeare...
There's not going to be a smoking gun where we get some written thing where Mr. Diggs came over to his house on a Thursday and they had yogurt together.
Oh, you mean like Michael Wood saying that in November of what year, I forget, he says Dudley Diggs was there and he mentioned the ship sinking in the Caribbean, and
go.
That's the origin of the Tempest. It was Dudley Diggs. I'm sure that's very debatable.
Well, the Tempest is roughly based on a series of pamphlets that were done about a wreck in the Bermudas.
Right, in
it's
the
called
Bermudas.
The Bermuda pamphlets.
Yeah.
And the what some people believe was a providential deliverance of the people in the boat.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, the play is set in the Mediterranean.
Right, right. And this Sir Dudley Diggs, of course, is the brother of Leonard, and he was involved in that enterprise. He was one of the organizers of it. I have to go back and look. So
that one diagram that Thomas Diggs has when he publishes the book that has his father's text and his,
And he has that diagram of the Copernican universe,
mm-hmm.
the sun centered, the planets going out, but then instead of putting the stars on the shelf,
right.
he draws stars all the way out, and he says, you know, this sphere extendeth out infinitely.
Yeah.
That's a real chapter in the history of astronomy,
yeah,
because it had quite an impact.
He did that 30 years before Bruno tried to do the same thing.
What year?
This is in the
1570s, I think.
1591, he actually published it. He didn't get it out in print until 1591, the revised Pantometria.
Huh. The original Pantometria was a lot earlier.
Galileo thought stars were two or three times out farther than Saturn.
Could I just interject? You know, in the world, speaking of, you know why the original Leonard Diggs did not publish was because he was involved in the Wyatt Rebellion against the monarch. And he almost lost, he lost some of his lands, but they allowed him to retain the title, and it was a big mess. And so he certainly couldn't put out an abhorrent view of the universe, according to the Catholic Church. So he just sat on it, and that's why so much later his son published it. Well, anyway, I'm sorry I cut you off there. Gary, were you going to finish your thought? I knew I'd forget it if I didn't say it, but that to me, that's an important point, why it wasn't published when you said, you know.
Yeah.
It wasn't published.
Yeah, that's always an important point to
because of the
stress
great
any limitations of science due to various social structures.
Yeah, well, he would have been fried, definitely, putting it out at that point. So. Well,
which is something that Galileo and Shakespeare can talk about.
Definitely.
They can definitely talk about when politics gets in the middle of your imagined world that you're trying to create.
Yeah, I think
right.
that's one of the appeals of this whole project.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so I think we have a number of things to pursue, and some of us have follow-ups that we were promising faithfully to do, and I want to thank you in all this wet weather and everything, bringing his working model of the perspective lens with
that's
him.
Neat.
That's, it really
yeah.
is neat.
Yeah, Ewan, thank you for bringing that.
Oh, you're welcome. You can have a look at it.
And I want to say goodbye to our remote consultants. We're very happy if any of you listened in to have you at this meeting. And we do welcome, I'll quit shouting them. We do welcome your comments and suggestions if you've been able to follow with all. And my husband says the ambient noise is terrible when you have you're trying to follow audio, but I hope most of it was audible to you. And thank you again for coming, all of you who are here in Tucson and those of you that are around the world. And
well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for calling us together, Gloria.
Yeah.
You're very welcome.
Okay.
Thank you so much for bringing that. I appreciate it.